Hundepraxis, der Podcast mit Christina Räder.
So, wir sind beim nächsten Experteninterview für den zweiten Dummy-Training-Online-Kongress. Und heute viele, viele Grüße auf die grüne Insel. Naja, es ist die grüne Insel, auf jeden Fall auf die Insel. Und wir werden ein bisschen international, denn heute habe ich hier Ellie Hoxburg zu Gast. Und ich werde gleich wieder ein bisschen switchen, dass wir beide uns besser verstehen. So, yeah, hello Ellie.
Hello.
Yeah, have you here. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
I think the best would be if you could maybe introduce you a little bit yourself, what you're doing, where you're coming from, how many dogs do you have, and stuff like this.
All that side. Okay, no problem. So, hello. Thank you very much, Christina, for inviting me to take part in this. It's fantastic. So I have been involved in gun dogs now since I bought my very first Labrador to train back in 97, which is like 100 years ago, it feels. And I was very lucky, I have to say. I was really lucky. I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. And I happened to buy, by chance, probably one of the best dogs I've ever had. He was what I call a paint-by-numbers dog. So if you know what I mean. Paint by numbers is like, you know, paint pink in the one and yellow in the two. He was like that. He was just a natural. He was really easy to train in respect. He would do whatever I wanted. He loved me. And it was, you know, it was a great relationship and great partnership. And it got me completely hooked. And probably wrongly, I thought, oh, this dog training's really easy.
It's good start for you.
Yeah. I mean, I was lucky and I happened to sort of, there was a catalogue of nice little accidents, let's put it that way, that happened that got me to a stage where, very lucky for me, I ended up qualifying him for the 2002 Retriever Championship here in the UK. So he was good. He was pretty good. I was the weak link and he was the good one. So if I didn't mess it up, you're okay.
It's often the thing that we are a little bit the part of the couple that is
it used to follow. If I didn't mess up, we did okay. So
good, yeah. Great.
It got me hooked and that was it. So I was sort of bitten by then. But I went through, which I think a lot of people probably have done through their career. I went through different, obviously he was retired at a certain age and then we lost him. And then, you know, you get hooked. So you buy another dog and then you buy another dog. And then you start to understand a bit more about the different pedigrees and the dogs that are out there. And, you know, you see such and such as a championship and you think, well, that looks nice. And I liked watching that and et cetera. So you end up sort of going down a road. And I probably would say I went down a bit of a road where I had a number of dogs who were very capable, but all presented different problems at different stages. And quite early doors in, so I'd had quite easy, this sounds awful. I had success quite early, and that isn't always the best thing because you've got to really, what I call cut your teeth, you've got to understand what you're doing. So then when the challenging dogs came along, when I mean challenging in terms of they weren't challenging, it was me, my brain that was challenged. How do I train, you know, how do I train this dog because it's very different to my others? Those are the ones that threw me what we call a curveball. And I think you become a better trainer from it. But also, I think you have to recognize when you need help and get help early. So that was lucky for me. I did that. And then since then, I have settled very much on a certain line of dogs, certain pedigree, which will go back to Mediterranean Blue. And he's produced a lot of very successful and, you know, really lovely dogs. And yes, from there,
I have one here.
There you go. Yeah. So I've had success since then and things I would probably say now. So my dog I'm running at the moment, my open dog, he is five and he's probably the best trained dog I've ever had. I've had to really learn, you know, the hard way as such. But it's got me completely mad keen on the whole area of working dogs. But also I've been teaching now for, probably about 7 or 8 years. And, you know, enjoy that. But that also gives you massive amounts of knowledge and information too. So I'm also an A-panel judge here in the UK. So I sort of look at the sport in every single different part of the whole circle. And that's field trials in particular. So that those are my baby, if you like. So that's me.
And you're also, I don't know if you have just Dutch dogs. Or are you breeding or with the Canada Rough River Gun Dogs?
Yes. So we're only, I only have boys. It's a joke with some of my clients who have girls. They're like, and then they go, oh, Ali, you don't like girls. I said, no, it's not that. It's just that I prefer having boys. Well, mainly because of trialing, because obviously when the bitch is in season, unless you're going to put them on a medication, you know, the worst thing I can imagine is to qualify for the championship or something like that. Or if dog's really going absolutely at its prime, and then you obviously have to stop because the season kicks in. So in fact, when I was a child, we always had girls as pets. But as soon as I went into working dogs, I decided to go for boys, and it just works for me. So yes, we have, I've probably had 3 dogs now, I would say, that have been used at stud a bit. One, Ralphie, who's my foundation dog a lot, and he's got offspring around the world. He just had that sort of temperament and ability that people wanted, and he's got offspring in all sorts of fears, you know, so he's gone on really well. And then all of my dogs bar one here, so we have 9, they all go back to Ralphie. So I kind of think once you found what works, you don't change it.
No, I can imagine. That's, of course, when you know the way a little bit, and yeah, then it's familiar when you have the pups after that. Very nice, very interesting way, and you just let us have a view about how you're thinking and what was your way, how to train, or how you get into training. And like you said, yes, when you win, and when it's really in the beginning, it's nice, but the work comes afterwards when the dogs coming in that maybe aren't the ones that make you present with everything, and you have to work on it. So you decided that topic that we should speak a little bit about the pressure in training, or maybe also a little bit the stressful behavior and stuff like this. I think we will come over it. Why was this the reason, or what was your reason to choose for that?
It's a pressure and sort of the repercussions of what happens when dogs feel pressure. It's such a massive part of training that I think a lot of people don't always identify it. So, but it's something that's really important to raise, because especially, you know, since I've been in the sport or been in training dogs, I have seen with us field trialers in particular, in some ways we're kind of our own worst enemy, because we tend to use certain dogs at stud that produce a certain type. And, you know, everybody is very aware probably that with genetics, you've got some dogs, what we call, who are very positively influencing genetics, and some dogs have got very strong genetic lines that perhaps are producing offspring that haven't got the most, that aren't always the most positive in some respects. And the biggest thing, of course, for me comes down to temperament. So you can have a dog that's fully health tested, you know, has a really good pedigree, but if it doesn't have a temperament that you can work with, it, for me, it's just not, you know, you're starting on a difficult place already. And the one, so I've seen over the years with teaching, more and more certain dogs are carrying certain, these sort of traits, if you like. I'm seeing more dogs than ever where we're seeing some sort of fear aggression issues, excuse me, or could be that they just really don't have the kind of temperament to cope with pressure. So that just to even cope with just basic training. And I've seen, you know, how if you get your training wrong, you'll feed that problem. So it's, I think it's something we really have to address, and at every level. So it might be that, you know, people who are perhaps going to watch this haven't got any ambition to go field trialing or to do a working test, etc. But they want a really nice trained dog to enjoy. And but it doesn't matter what your goal is, if you like, for your dog, the same issues can occur no matter if you're beginner starting or you're at the very top of the sport. Because if we train inappropriately, is what I would say in some ways, or maybe not even inappropriately, if we're not always aware of what we're doing as human beings on our dogs, that is where this chain can happen. And like I said, I think you've got to take into account the genetics behind dogs. So often when I've got, for example, people coming to me with their puppies or young dogs and they need to come for lessons, you know, they've come to me for lessons, they've been recommended, for example, most of the time I always ask them, well, how's your dog bred? Because it can really help me, not because I'm going to sit there and, you know, criticize one way or the other, that this is their dog and they love their dog and they're working with them, but it helps sometimes to know what's behind the breeding, because it can also sometimes just give them that sort of little aha moment. Ah, okay, now I can see why, because this line has a tendency to be that way. So like I said, some lines have very strong impact on temperament and performance, and others aren't so much. But it can be very, you know, illuminating to find out how a dog is bred. So yeah, so the reason why I chose pressure is because it's something that I think people don't realize they're often actually creating. They're trying to do the right thing with their dogs and their training. But it goes, it's even before you start taking your dog out training, it can be something you need to think about way before you even get your puppy. It's as simple as, you know, you need to really plan. So if you're not an experienced handler or trainer, just even little considerations of things like, where's my puppy going to live? Where am I getting it from? Is it a breeder who lives out on a lovely farm, but in the middle of nowhere, and potentially maybe that puppy never sees anybody but the breeder? Or has the breeder got a plan with the puppies before you even go and pick it or choose it, that that will help guide you to make sure you've got the right puppy, but also a puppy that already comes with some preconditioning, if we put it that way. So there's lots that a breeder can do. And if you do your research and you do your homework correct, most breeders, in my experience, wouldn't be too offended if you said to them, I would like it, if possible, you could do X, Y, and Z with my puppy, because I know that these things will help me to have a puppy that is going to go on and have a fulfilled life, but also be able to have coping mechanisms. And I've done quite a lot of research in this and lots of reading about the whole start of puppies, because it's so crucial. If you think about puppy, all our dogs, if you take, for example, Labradors and as one of the main breeds that we tend to train for field trials. If you look at the life scale of a Labrador, so roughly, if we said on average, say they tend to live till about 11, 12, 13, the dog's development happens in the first 2 years of its life. If you look at the very first 6 months of that dog's life, there's a massive amount of change going on. And the first 12 months, there's a massive amount of change going on. So because they basically are fully mature physically and normally mentally between sort of 18 months to 2 years of age, depending if it's a dog or bitch, etc. If you think about it, where the dog's development comes right from the time it's born. So if it's born into an environment where the breeder follows a program where they're just going to very gently place some slightly, it's not stress is not the right word, but you're going to make little situations slightly little uncomfortable for a puppy early doors, and we're not talking, you know, being mean. There's a little test where you can take a puppy and literally just very gently lift it up and lift it down and do, you know, two or three times a day, holding a cold cloth on its tummy so it goes, oh, I don't like that. These little stressors will affect the dog's mental ability later on in life. It's like you're giving them coping skills before they've even got their eyes open and can walk. These tiny little things that you can ask the breeder to do will make a big difference. And scientifically, they've proven that work. So for me, I want people to understand, you know, I've heard it time and time again. I want people to understand that I've heard this expression, you might have heard it, Christina. Let the puppy be a puppy. And that, for me, it's like a red rag to a bull, because it's like the worst thing you can think about for me. So it's like taking a child.
I agree with that.
If we take a five-year-old kid and we say, right, you can eat what you want, you can go to bed when you want, but when you turn six, suddenly you're going to bed at 7 o'clock and you're only going to be able to eat these foods because that's what we agree is best for you. You will have the worst meltdown child who will have absolutely no, because the child's got no boundaries or has no schedule or has no constructive day because it's living like a feral, chaotic life. And then to turn around at 6 years of age, we're now going to change everything. It's mean and cruel. You wouldn't do it. You know, you wouldn't set yourself up to fail. You would have absolute anarchy. So the same thing goes for puppies. Why would you let the puppy run wild and do what it likes and, you know, chew on everything, get up at any time, do what, you know, people say, well, let a puppy be puppy. It's the worst thing you can think about. You always need to think about shaping the puppy, how you want that puppy to develop, because it's so mean to think, right, you're 6 months of age now. Here we go. We're going to start kicking in a whole load of rules. Well, most, you know, dogs are survivors. That's why they've lived with us for so many years, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. They're survivors. They are not going to want to go from, I've got all this freedom and I can do whatever I like, and now suddenly you're going to change the rules. They're not going to go with that easily. So for me, it's you know, it's starting them off the right way. And on that thought, I think a lot of people as well, I know if we just, you know, we've been through lockdown recently, and I did a number of videos for my clients because they couldn't come and have lessons, etc. But some people really struggle to put a lesson together because they don't sort of think perhaps as a dog would be thinking. They sort of think a bit more of like a human. And that's something that people just need to get some help, seek help and advice. Go with an action plan. So don't just go out and throw dummies for your dog. Actually have, you know, look at your dog's ability and see, right, where are my weakest points with my training? Is this covered off properly? And that's what's really important. And lots of people don't have that strategy. They don't say, they just say, oh, we're going to go training with some friends. And then basically all they're doing is they're picking dummies. Isn't constructive in my book. And I'd rather not do that. So that's, you know, it's just those little things. So starting your dog off the right way is really important. And it needs to be done in terms of what you're trying to achieve with your dog. So, you know, keeping it short and basic and simple exercises. Do you know what you're trying to accomplish in a lesson? And it's recognizing when you've gone too far as well. So if we go back to pressure as a starting point, the pressure for me comes in a variety of ways, and it's what I see regularly. If, you know, you've seen it time and time again, I'm sure, Christina, where you've seen a dog, it will take, you know, do a fantastic retrieve. So it goes out, picks a dummy, you know, really for lovely retrieve. It, maybe it's gone over a wall, it's gone through, you know, gone over a river, it's done a really long retrieve, and it's done everything very nicely. And on the way back, the dog's physiology changes. So yeah. I will see this quite often where the body language of that dog on its return starts to change. And as it gets closer and closer to the handler, fundamentally the change happens more. Because what they don't, you know, handlers aren't realizing is whatever goes on at heel around here, as in next to you, will have a massive impact on what goes on in that dog. And dogs tell me lots of things about their handlers. So I can see a dog that is, you know, for example, starting to mouth dummies. See a lot of that. Dogs that maybe put hackles up when they come in. So you know what I mean by the hackles going up, the fur on the back along the spine goes up. So dogs that come in with a slightly low body carriage, so tail might be down, might be wagging, but it might be down, and maybe slightly lack a little bit of a crouched position as they're coming in. Those are all really key indicators to tell me that that handler has created those problems. And that's the thing that people don't realize, is that any issues, so some people say, oh, it's a really naughty dog, he's so naughty. No, he's just not trained. Appropriately trained. So it's recognizing that. And it's not me trying to sit there and criticize people, but it's about, I want people to be more aware of what's going on with their dog so that they can then change their training or realize they need to retrain something. Perhaps they've missed a step or they haven't covered it off properly. And so pressure can come, like I said, from a number of ways, but normally, fundamentally, it's often the handler. You know, sometimes as well, if people go training in groups, they aren't always recognizing what the mental age is of their dog and their ability. So sometimes it's the fact that they're trying to do the same retrieves as their friend, but their friend's dog's a year old.
Oh, yeah.
You know, go to the level of your dog. Don't set it up to fail. The other thing, obviously, we've mentioned genetics, but also environmental factors. I'm not sure if you have this same situation over on the continent, but I've met a few people that have said, oh, I took my puppy along with me on a shoot day so they could meet some of the other dogs. And I just think, are you bonkers? There's socializing, and then there's this, like, literally taking your puppy and dropping it into an absolute sort of environment, which is a nightmare for the poor thing. Oh, and yes, unfortunately, he got bitten by one of the dogs. Well, yeah, I'm not surprised. You know, it's just people not realizing that, you know, they can create, they're trying to do the right thing, but by not be guessing, thinking about it in a proactive way, that they need to think about what does that dog need. They sort of, they can create problems. And dogs do get PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome. They can have problems where something happened. So it could be where they're in a park and unfortunately they got attacked by another dog. It could be that they had an accident, and they will relate either the environment or the situation to that awful memory. And it can be really hard to undo that. So it's being careful not to have that situation in the first place. But I have seen dogs with post-traumatic stress syndrome, and it's taken some time to really, one, to understand it, and two, to really train to change that perception of that dog about that situation. So it can just even be as simple thing as a dog has an accident, for example, jumps a wall, doesn't jump well, and falls down, and perhaps, you know, hits itself on the way down. It might now have an anxiety about walls, or it might just be having anxiety about that wall. But if something happened, there might have been somebody nearby, like a dummy thrower, for example. Suddenly, that dog's now fearful of dummy throwers. Not because the dummy thrower's done anything wrong, but the dog's associated that accident with that situation. And it's made the link. And it's, you know, not the right link, but it's made a link anyway. And now you've got a double problem. So it's just recognizing some of that sometimes. You know, we all have things that happen in life, but it's just working out. You sometimes need to step back and assess what's going on. So for me, I think a lot of pressure is about recognizing and stopping straight away. I had a lesson here today with one of my clients who's only been coming to me for probably about 2 months now. And she lives a little bit of a distance away, so she can't come too regularly. But her little bitch is full on, what we call full on. She needed the, you know, the puppy work done, which she unfortunately wasn't there. So this little dog really didn't have many boundaries. So, you know, I'm going to jump up at you. I don't care. I'm just going to jump up at you and I'm going to get into a bit of a manic state because I'm totally overwhelmed and excited because I've missed all that bit of my training. And so obviously we were trying to do lots of work that would just get her focused and calm and get her relaxed. And it was a tough challenge for the owner. And she's done some really good work with her. And I said to her when she came today, I said, we're going to do something completely different to what we've done in the last sessions, because what I want her to understand is when she comes training, it could be all sorts of nice things to do, you know, where we're not just doing heel work and we're not just being on the lead. We're going to do lots of things that are different, but give her a different focus. So she doesn't start to think, oh, I'm just going to do heel work or sits and stays. And, you know, everybody says it's not the most exciting thing. And so they want to do retrieves, but I'm saying, no, we need to get the basics in, but we can still do the basics, but let's just mix it up. So we used a load of agility equipment today and just got her used to doing some really unusual things with her body. So bending in different ways and climbing in and out of crates, and just so that she had a different aspect of training. And I think that's important, is that you mix it up. And this dog's attention span's not great. So what I tend to do is say, right, we're going to do 3 or 4 minutes. Then we release her. You go bomb around the field for a minute, get that out, and then we'll come back and do it again. We don't do half an hour of pure focus because that would just set her up to fail. So that these little things is recognizing for me that you can make a big difference with just changing your training and having that awareness.
Sorry, yes, so very nice. Good. Maybe if I can come a little bit to the point back, you said right in the beginning that the dogs are you see that they not always have the possibility to cope with pressure. And you also mentioned that, yes, of course, I have to see where the dog's coming from, where they are bred, where how they're living there, how they're raised up, and also the genetic point. Do you see it's just an issue if I think it's, getting more and more a problem that the dogs are in pressure when they're in training, or that they do things that, I recognize that it's taking something about pressure if they're whining, if they're running in, if they're doing things like this. And I also think we have more and more dogs from this. Do you think it's more from the beginning, the bred and the, how they're raised up, or do they also change? Because now we are speaking about the Labradors. So what do you think? Is it a mix from both, how they are trained by the people, that they don't have any borders? Or do you also recognize that it's a genetic point where some lines are getting into a direction that's taking it more and more?
I think both. I think it starts with the genetics. I think you've got, I think if you talk to any of the trialers that we all know well, known names in this country who've been at the top of the profession for many years, I think that if you ask them about the dogs today versus, say, dogs from 20, 30 years ago, I think there is a definite shift in the way that we're breeding our dogs, for example. There are more people in the sport for a start. Absolutely. There's more people involved. So therefore there's a bigger demand for puppies. And so there, you know, there's a lot of puppies out there that are perhaps where before breeding would have been a little bit more controlled, if that's the best way to explain it.
I can imagine.
I definitely think that there are dogs I've seen more dogs that exhibit perhaps not the most positive traits naturally. So there's obviously nature and nurture. So if you're starting off with a dog, had a lesson with somebody yesterday, and it was absolutely paramount and obvious to me that the little puppy who is 16 weeks of age, it was her first lesson here, The owner's very experienced with dogs. She's had lots of Labradors and other dogs in her time. So she knows what she's doing. She's extremely patient, very kind, very sensible. But that little dog just showed every exhibit of being frightened. And it wasn't anything that the owner's done. It's this is this little dog. This is what we've got. So she's we're working out a game plan for this little pup to try and move her on gently into her training, but recognizing that it's going to probably be a much slower pace than perhaps we would take another puppy who hasn't got any of those ingrained traits. You know, this puppy's come with that. That was very obvious. There's nothing that's happened to this puppy to create this situation. So yeah, I do think we're seeing more dogs with those worries, definitely. And then again, I think also if you looked back, if you go onto YouTube for a giggle at some stage and you look back at the old footage of videos of field trialing in this country, and we're talking really old ones, you know,
all my time,
and I'm old. But if you look back at some of the videos, we never did the work that we require a lot more of our dogs now, an awful lot more. You know, the distances have gone up, goodness knows how long. You know, what we ask for dogs to taking straight lines, to holding areas, the accuracy that we want from dogs now. So I think, yes, I mean, the standard has gone way, way, way up. And even the time that I've been doing this, the standard has gone way through the roof in that respect from where we started. That's a good thing, but the downside of that is that that creates pressure in its own. And I think, you know, people are competitive. I was teaching this year back in Germany, and when you put people in a group, sometimes they don't always realize that they can become competitive in training. And or, you know, people don't want to be embarrassed because their dog's done this or that. Because we train in with our peers and our colleagues, and we don't want our dog to embarrass us. And that for me is the failure of training, because animals are animals. They're never going to be 100% every day. That just isn't, you'll set yourself up to fail if you think they would. It just doesn't happen. You know, humans are not infallible, neither are animals. So I think that we require more from our dogs now, and I think we ask more from our dogs, and I think that in turn has created its own level of pressure, because now we're expecting dogs to have even more training required for what we're asking them to do in terms of the standard. So I think it's both. I think it's both a genetic breeding thing, program thing, and I think it's also what we're asking of these dogs now.
Yes, so thank you very much. I don't want to break down, but it was a question I had in my mind. So that's good. Yeah, now when you described it a little bit now, what you're doing on, so to avoid this pressure or to manage it, because when you say I see it often, and it's maybe also, yes, of course, because we have more dogs that are coming with this genetic things. How do you get into training with a puppy? You said now with the client, you were doing basic things, mixed it up. How do you go forward with those dogs? How do you start with a puppy when maybe it's your own, or what's the first things you're doing?
So I'm a big believer in doing work that really gets the dog's communication and my communication on the same page straight away. And call it what you like, whether, you know, I use voice, I use sound. So, you know, people are familiar with clickers. And I do I don't like the word positive reinforcement. The reason being, I like the positive bit, but reinforcement sounds like I'm making them do it, and that's not how it works. So I like to bring a dog on very much what we call shaping. So I want to obviously give the dog the best communication I can by being as clear as I can. And a lot of the time, sounds daft, but a lot of the time it's me being quiet. And it's me interacting with the dog with my body language and rewarding the behavior I want. So it's basically using praise as a tool that is very effective. You know, it's very powerful. I've got a puppy here who's a grandson of my original foundation dog. And he is now, I think he's just come out for 13 weeks. So he's 12 or 13 weeks. I'm not very good at looking at the calendar. Anyway, I was blown away how fast by just, I'm playing some little games with him. I'm literally sitting on the floor with some of his dog food. And I'm just getting him to understand what I want him to do in terms of lots of puppies. When you go to give them something, you know, a treat, et cetera, or food, they'll try and snatch it out of your hand. And so I was just showing him how I wanted him to take it. And so I was rewarding him when he got it right and withholding it when he got it wrong. So he's very much pause, pause, pause. I'm going to get your hand. And so he learned within 30 seconds. Couldn't believe it. It's like, crumbs, this is a fast puppy, of what I was asking. So he was restraining himself because he really wants to just jump on my hand with his paws. I just literally just said, well, no, the hand closes when you do that, my little friend. You don't get the treat anymore. And within 30 seconds, like I said, he'd worked out, right, I just have to sit here. Then she gives it to me. So I'm using really simple things like hand is open, you get the treat. Hand is closed, you don't get it. So it's a really easy communication. There's not a lot of words going on. There's not a lot of chatter going on. I'm trying to use my body language to show him correct. Because dogs are the best body language readers ever. They're phenomenal. You know, we have a language, we can understand each other really easily. I mean, you're amazing how you can understand English and I'm hopeless with everything else. But dogs,
I will do the subtitle. Down there.
Dogs are just on another level of body language reading. And they have to, because that's how they've managed to work out what we want, because we are not as bright as them often. I start my puppies off with doing a lot of work where I make it a little bit of a game, but there's a lesson into all of it. I started doing a little game with them where it's got a combination of different really positive lessons. You literally have your puppy at, you place them at heel. They don't know heel. You know, he's 13 weeks of age. And I'm holding him, supporting him. I'm like, you know, kneeling down on the floor, and I've just got him in my, where he would normally be if I was stood up and he was a fully grown dog. So I'm starting from the position where I want him to adopt, to say, this is always going to be your golden place. You're always going to be in this place. So unless you're doing a retrieve, this is where you're going to be, or you're free running. So, you know, I start with that. So I place him next to me, and all I'm going to do is just support his front, to perhaps put my hand between his front legs. And then all I've got is a bit of white towel on the floor. Nothing exciting, bit of white towel. And I have two treats. And I throw a treat out onto the floor, onto the towel, so he can see it. So it just sounds like I'm here. And he might go, oh, let me go. It's treat, treat. And all I do is I just wait until he relaxes. It's like, you don't move if you're going to go for it, what we call push behavior. And I just hold on to him. And so the little rules are, he's got to be in the right place next to me. He's also got to be still, and he's got to be looking at that treat. And if he's doing those three things, and we're talking him, you know, I'm not holding him forever. I'm literally holding him for probably less than a second. But if he's still and he's looking at the treat, he gets to go to get it. So he gets released on his name, because that's going to be his go command. And he gets his treat. Fab. Like this game. This is nice. This is easy. And then all I do is wait for him to eat it. And then I just put the word in come, which is my recall. So come. And he gets a retreat on the way back. What I will do is put a collar on him at some stage, so that I can then just, we've probably heard about these, you just then turn it into a collar grab. So how many times have you been out somewhere and suddenly something's happened and somebody's turned up, or you want to quickly get hold of your dog, but you don't want them to do the characteristic, you've got hold of me, I can't move. Oh my God, you've got hold of me. So I condition my dogs to accept collars, and then eventually just getting hold of the scruff, that it doesn't freak them out. Because sometimes I just have to go, oh, look, there's a car, and it's appeared from nowhere.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I don't want them to go, oh, I can't move. you know, so I need them to accept that. So this game, if I, when they're coming back in, they see the treat like, hello, it's here. If I then just literally just get hold of the collar or just touch the puppy's neck to start with, before they get the treat, they get completely conditioned to whatever's happening here is not bothering me because I've got this food right in my face and I'm going to get it as a reward. So it's just simple stuff like that is how I start. And what has been really good was working with this with a number of clients now. When you then go to do your first retrieves with a tennis ball or dummy, whatever you're doing, they're already steady. So they don't run in because they recognize the pattern of, oh, you're holding me. The dummy goes out. I stay there. I look at it. I'm focused. And then I get released. And then I pick it. And then I come back. So it's, you don't have any of that sort of anxiety around retrieving, which I think people do get because they're like, hey, come in, grab the dummy off the dog, you know, all that. We don't do any of that because we've done all this preconditioning.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's even things like when you get to the stage when you're then onto dummies with your young puppy or your dog, I do a very simple thing, whereas when I get my delivery, I don't make a big song and dance about it. But if I've got a young dog or a puppy, I take the delivery and then I just give it back to them. So they don't go, well, she's going to take my toy. I'm not coming because she's going to take my toy away. And that's not fair. I want to keep it. But if you keep giving it back, they're like, oh, that's okay. I don't lose it. I don't have to run around like a whirling dervish, which I've seen other people's dogs do.
Oh, yes.
So it's just really simple things that make a massive difference. And what you're also doing all through this work, because it's all done in a play, high value, you know, value to the dog because it's getting fed, because they need to eat to survive and it's ingrained in them. What you're doing is you're building a really strong trust between you and your dog from the start. And so the precious stuff shouldn't, you know, come up. But if you did find something, so we've got where we live, I've got from our garden to go into the training field, there's like a drop. And so we've got like a bridge that goes across it. And some dogs, because it's elevated and there's air, it's a solid bridge, but it's elevated and there's air.
Okay,
they go across it and they're like, you know, they go across like a cat on ice. But so it's just even simple things like that is getting them, when they do come up to something that's a bit, ooh, this is a bit scary, you can very easily turn that into a game by just putting a few treats down the bridge. And then they go, oh, like Pac-Man. Dum, 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 dum. That's all right. I'm not even worrying about what that bridge is anymore because I'm focused on eating this food. So it's just, yeah, for me, if you give them coping skills and you give them positive training, you know, but you're clear about it. You're not, some people get worried about using treats and they say, oh, I don't want my dog to always be just looking at the treats. And I don't have that problem because one of the easiest games I always play with these puppies is give me eye contact and you'll get a treat. You'll get a click and a treat. And not, they don't, if they look at the treat, they don't get anything. And they soon work out, okay, I've got to look at her, you know, because I'm building that relationship. That's what I want them to do. I want them to look and go, oh yeah, you're all right. Yeah. So it's simple things. Starting that way, I think is the way for me. So when I do get some people where there isn't that communication, there isn't that trust, and people tend to get quite cross and they get upset about with their dog. And you can see that and they're frustrated and they're like, why does my dog do this? Why does this? Well, basically it's only because the dog just doesn't understand. It's as simple as that. And you just got to go back and start again. It is more challenging because you're going to push against habit that's been built up maybe over months. But it is, if you're persistent and you really want to nail this, you can turn it around. But I think people sometimes they forget they should go and ask help. Certainly in my country, there are people who are brilliant at training and they you know, I would definitely point them in the right direction, say go to these people. But there are still people, I would say, who are training dogs who don't have that knowledge or understanding, and unfortunately that can not go well. So you need to do your research as to who you're asking for help.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's quite correct. So now you said, or it's maybe you also talked about group training, and maybe one question about it. When do you start with the young dogs or with group training? Do you take them a longer time for their own, or because what you said also, it's that the people, they can't make them free from being competitive the whole time. I think it's also different if some persons are good at this, but how do you manage this with young dogs? How do you go with this forward?
The fundamentals for me is if anyone's coming for they want to do group work with me, the first and foremost, they have to come and do some one-to-ones. I won't let them loose in a group because I need to make sure that the real basics are there so that the dog can walk to heel without, without any problem as such. So literally can walk to heel, ideally off lead as well. Maybe not in the group, but could walk off lead on a one-to-one. So if I know the fundamentals of the safety stuff, recall is there, walking to heel is there. Just the real safety basics. If those are in place, then we introduce them to group. But my groups are really small. So, for example, if I'm doing a puppy group, I'll probably the maximum number of puppies I'd have on one session is six. And ideally, I'd have four. And we don't have any socializing. We don't go, let's go have a puppy party and left off lead and let's go mad and hoon around. Because I want them to understand that they're going to be doing some training. The training will be fun, but part of their training is learning to cope with seeing other dogs, but they don't go and interact with them because we're training. So, the rules are when you're on a lead, you are calm. You need to be with your handler, focused on what your handler is working on with you. And of course, it's a challenge for all of them, but you do simple things like you don't get people to sit with their puppy for ages watching other puppies. That's going to set them up to fail if they're really young puppies. So if we're talking like a 6-month-old puppy, 5-month, 6-month-old puppy, you don't make them sit still for ages.
No,
That's just like bored, gonna whine, gonna bark, gonna pull, gonna chew this, gonna just, oh, I'm bored, don't want to do this, let's go. So that's, we don't do that. We do a lot of moving. So we do lots of change of direction, lots of moving around. We do some sits and stays when they're ready to do it. But we do it in a way that nothing's really long and protracted. So we make sure that it's at the level ready for those dogs mentally. And then I mix it up. So it wouldn't be a whole session on just doing heel work or walking to heel, doing recalls or stays. We would then go and have a go on some of the agility kit so that we give dogs a bit of a change of scene and they get to do something physically with their bodies that's different to what they've just been doing, so that you mix it up, you keep it fresh and keep it easy. And that really seems to have been a really good method for developing a puppy all around. And they just seem to just cope really well with it. And then their learning just goes, fast because they're really enjoying their sessions. But sometimes I'll say to people during the session, so I've had people say, well, can I come for a 2-hour lesson with my young dog? I'm like, no, you cannot. You are joking. You're not going to focus for 2 hours. Yeah, are you expecting your dog to focus for 2 hours?
Yes,
You're mad.
it's also a thing. The people that are always telling, oh, my dog's doing this and that and this and that. And yeah, when they stand there with some people around and you're maybe talking to another one or doing with another one, they're always talking to each other and they're wondering why the dogs aren't calm and quiet and yeah, sitting relaxed there. Yeah, it's also a thing. The people maybe have to realize, yeah, it's not the dog Fire's on. It's hard for you.
No. If I see young dogs, you always know when they've had too much mentally because the behavior starts to go. So as soon as we, if I, before that happens, ideally, I'll say, let's finish. You'll go put your dog away. You can keep yours out a little longer, but yours needs to go now. That's enough. It's done enough. And if, you know, I generally, everybody, I'm lucky enough, I've got a great client group, and they would all say, okay, I recognize that you know what you're talking about, Ali. So yeah, I'll go put my puppy away in the car. And I said, you know, just traveling here, coming to a new place in a group is a massive learning curve. It's huge, let alone doing anything actually in the group. So let's just, you know, recognize it for what it is and just take little bits at a time. So yeah, sometimes they get told after half an hour where we haven't done a huge amount, but that's enough. You've done enough with that little dog. Otherwise you're going to start to push too hard, and that's when you'll get the pressure coming in, and with the whining, lunging on a lead, you know, really just all just getting bored and fed up and thinking actually training really is crap. And you know, we don't want that. We want dogs to enjoy training. But yeah.
Oh yes, so,
yeah,
quite good point. Yes, and maybe just a little bit for the end, do you make any differences between training pet dogs or between training dogs? What do you do the same for the beginning, for the basics? Or how do you make a difference? Is there a difference for you, or how do you deal with that?
You know, I'm, it's funny enough, I've had a few folks, I have a few people who come along who've had dogs before, you know, maybe they've said, oh, actually, I really want some help with this one. Or I've been recommended to you because I've got problems with this one. And sometimes the first thing they say to me is, I don't want to take it field trialing. I just want to take it picking up. I'm not interested in going field trialing, Ali. I don't want to do competitions. And I just laugh and go, no. We train to the same standard. It doesn't matter. I'm not interested to know what you want to do or not want to do, but we're going to train to the same standard, because why wouldn't you want a really nicely trained dog? It doesn't matter if you're going to compete or not. So that's something that I always make sure people are aware. And it doesn't matter if it's going to be a pet. I want it to be a credit to them that they enjoy taking it out because it's really well trained. And when they can see another dog coming, which they don't like the look of, they can get that recall straight away. And that dog does respond and doesn't bomb off to go and see some other dog that might not do it any help, you know, service. So no, for me, it doesn't matter. All of the fundamental starts are the same. I had a few people when we could start training and during lockdown, I had a few people come with pet dogs because they hadn't had the opportunity to socialize their dogs. And they maybe were, you know, they were in a house where they just had the one puppy. So they hadn't got that opportunity to take them out and meet other dogs, or, you know, or just see other dogs particularly. And that in itself created a whole, we've got a whole load of dogs out there that have been affected by COVID. There's no choice about it. And so I was as keen to help them because they were having behavioral problems. And I'm not a behaviorist at all. I definitely wouldn't, you know, say that I am that person at all, but I understand behavior and I understand the you know, signs, etc., you know, dogs exhibiting behavior and how to hopefully refocus dogs to go away from those fear anxiety issues. So I've had quite a few people I've helped just to get their dog to the point where they could go and take it out to a park or to the beach, because we're close to the beach here, and enjoy being a pet owner. So for me, it's not all about the field trials and being at the top of the sport. It's about trying to do what I can to get people to have a really good relationship with their dog, that they can enjoy their dog and not feel like it's a stressful, you know, I've had people phone me in tears. I can't take my dog out. I can't walk it on a lead. I don't know what to do. You know, should I rehome it? Should I give it away? I don't know what to do, you know, and that's a really sad place to be. And not every dog suits every person. That's something I would say.
Yes.
That's not always going to work. And sometimes it's recognizing that and saying, you know, actually, this dog is just not going to be the one you need for what you want it to do. And sometimes you're better to say to people, it's not being harsh or brutal, but you just want to be really clear to them. You know, they say, oh, no, I want to pursue it. Actually, you're going to, both of you are not going to benefit from this relationship because you're just not matched. They're either the breed's inappropriate, the temperament's inappropriate for you. And, you know, I had a dog I brought over from America. He would have been about 4 years ago. And I mean, to say he was wired to the moon would be putting it politely. He was the most high drive dog I've ever had, ever owned. And I recognized quite quickly that it wasn't going to matter training or nurturing. For what I wanted for field trials, he was not going to be the fit at all. That just was never going to happen. And after his basic training, he went into our military dog program.
Okay. So
he's now an explosive detection dog. And they sent me all the training videos of him. Oh, my goodness. Talk about a dog that's fallen on his feet in the right job. Brilliant. But for field trials, absolutely never on this planet. So, you know, you just got to recognize sometimes is just what you're asking that dog to do, you know, round hole, square peg ain't going to happen. So, yeah, you have to be fair to dogs.
You have to be, honored with yourself. So you have to be clear with yourself also what you want from a dog and what the dog can deliver if you do the right things. Also very nice thing you mentioned now. So I think, thank you very much at this time because, I see we can talk and talk many hours about this different things, but there were very, very interesting points in it. Yeah, how you put your view onto dogs and onto training and what's the reason why a dog should be nice trained if it's a pet or a training dog. So now here in Germany, we don't have that many field trials. At the moment, no one. We have also always to travel. I think you knew it, to Belgium, to Austria, to Czechia, wherever, Denmark. But of course, we are also competing in the dummy tests, and it's even if you start in a beginner class, you have to realize if I want my dog to be there clear with me. Or I do my best to be clear with him. It's not just in the test situation. It's all about the basics. So we come always back to the basics, do them properly.
Yes.
And absolutely. Take your time to make them nice. And then you can raise up or build up the training very, very good or easy or a little bit more easy if you fail in that. So maybe coming back to the basics and looking where the dog come from and what's your expectation about what you want to do with the dog. Mm-hmm. Very important. So there were very interesting points in this interview. Thank you very much for that. And I think there will be very much effort for the people in it.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And of course, if somebody is searching for any information, we will do the link to your website, to your training, because you also do group training sometimes here in Germany if you're invited, but you also can do training behind your house, like you said.
Yes, we're lucky. Yeah, we do.
Yeah,
we're very lucky.
So nice. And of course, if there are any training wishes, they can contact you. So we will put the link down. And so thank you very much and have a good time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hundepraxis, der Podcast mit Christina Räder.